Hi, this is Tiffany. I just wanted to drop in to our podcast today and acknowledge COVID-19. The Digital to Learn podcast has pre-recorded episodes, and we do plan to continue on with those during this time. But we also just want to stop and acknowledge everything that you're going through and let you know that we're all in this together. And we hope that now more than ever, you find our content about digital learning relevant and useful in your daily lives. Everybody stay safe, and we just want to wish you some happy listening.
There's this thing called entanglement, where you can take two quantum particles and you can entangle them through some mechanism. Like, for example, if they're atoms, you could put them close to each other and shoot them with a laser beam, and that will then entangle them. And then you can separate them by millions of miles. And because of this entanglement, when you measure one, if you observe one, and maybe it collapses in some state, but it's not something that's predetermined. It's just something that it collapses. And somehow, you know, and this behavior was baked into the universe when it was created. Somehow, when you observe one, then the other one collapses in the exact same state.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. This is Tiffany, and I'm here with my co-host, Brad. Hi, Brad.
Hello, hello. Glad to be here.
And our special guest today is Jim Weaver. Jim Weaver is a Java developer, author, and speaker with a passion for cloud-native applications, machine learning, and quantum computing. He is a Java champion and a Java 1 rock star. Jim has written books including Inside Java, Beginning J2EE, the Pro Java FX series, and Java with Raspberry Pi. Jim currently works as a quantum developer advocate at IBM and speaks internationally at software technology conferences. We are excited to feature Jim as our Digital to Learn podcast guest. Please join us in welcoming Jim to the show. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you.
We're going to kick it off, as we always do, with an icebreaker. We've got a few questions for Jim. Could you tell us your favorite musical decade, group, and or song?
My daughter tells me that people land upon their favorite groups and songs and favorite styles of music when they're about 16. And so naturally, you know, if you believe that, then my favorite era was kind of the late 60s, early 70s. And I think, Brad, you would probably agree with that assessment, that late 60s was pretty happy music, you know, pretty feel-good music. Early 70s, pre-disco, was pretty cool. And, you know, just like the classic rock era.
Yeah.
That's probably my happy place.
Favorite group in that era?
Oh, so many of them. There are ones that are just really happy, like the Rascals.
Okay.
Blood, Sweat, and Tears was one of my favorite. Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, I used to listen to a lot of those, a lot of that. Tommy James, Crimson Clover, I just listened to that over and over.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I think we're getting along with this guy.
Yeah.
It's going to work out, I think. Okay, next question. Favorite vacation destination? Either a place you've been or a place you'd like to go.
Right, right. In my job, I travel extensively. And I'm able to scope out a lot of places. I think our go-to for as a family is just Daytona Beach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we like to go down there, and we've been there so many times in the same place that we don't have to do a lot of work to try to scope out the area. We just kind of go there and then hit the beach. But some of the more exotic or some of the more interesting vacation destinations have been, and ones that we're thinking about are exploring the south of France more.
Mm. Yeah.
There are some just really beautiful places there that we haven't been yet. And this year we're going to go back to Sydney and Melbourne.
Oh, wow.
And we're going to do a bit of exploring while we're
hopefully
down
the
there.
Virus will be over by then.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And we'll go over to New Zealand.
Oh, very
where
good.
Where Mike's been quite a bit, and kind of check some things out there. That's an area that we haven't explored too much.
Yeah.
Okay, this question is a deal breaker. Okay? just saying up front. PC or Mac?
Kind of go back and forth on that one.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. Historically, I started out actually on a TRS-80.
Wow. Trash 80.
Trash 80. That's right. And then went to IBM PC.
Okay.
And kind of grew up with the Windows thing. And the Windows thing got kind of weird. And then I kind of went back to went over to Mac, and then the Mac thing became really tight because they control everything, you know, the environment and what runs, just
right.
Like the iPhone. And that's good, but then when you got too much control over a platform, then you start to chafe a little bit and want to do something different on it, and so some of the innovations. Then, like in the areas, for example, of GPUs and things like that, then tend to happen maybe on Windows. Mm. And so, you know, PC. So I kind of go back and forth on that, and then over to Linux sometimes. So,
okay.
Yeah.
That's good perspective. All right, another tough one. Biggest pet peeve?
I don't really have any pet peeves. Yeah, I really don't. I think the older we get, the more we've been given grace, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the more we tend to give grace and maybe not let things bother us so much. So I don't really have a big pet peeve.
Okay.
It's very reflective of your musical decade, just happy and calm and chill. And
absolutely.
Yeah. All right, we're going to dive into some discussion questions, especially related to your professional experience. Can you just tell us first, though, a little bit more about you and your professional journey and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. Well, I already mentioned that I started out on a TRS-80. Mm-hmm. And for those listening that have no idea what that is, in the very early 80s and late 70s, there were mainframes, but it hadn't really been democratized yet. And then folks like Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, the folks at Radio Shack, others, then created personal computers that then we could play with. I had some formal training in BASIC on mainframes in the 70s, but never really got excited about it till PCs came out. And then from then on, I've been just kind of a lifelong developer, mostly on PCs, Macs, things like that, my mini computers. I've then professionally worked for companies like EDS and Oracle, IBM, but spent almost half of my career also as a consultant or as a business owner whose business writes software, develops software. And so it's always kind of been a passion. You know, they say if you're doing something that you love, you never work a day in your life. That's kind of like it's been for me, except for, you know, when you're trying to pay the bills, maybe you have to work a little more than you wanted to, especially if the technologies aren't as interesting, you know, the ones that you have to work on to pay the bills at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I'm in a really nice time of life where it seems that every technology that I am working with, I really, really enjoy. So where we're at now then is about 4 years ago, I learned about quantum computing. Mm-hmm. And it just happened to be at a conference where a gentleman by the name of Vincent Cerf, he's the guy that created one of the underlying technologies for the internet called TCP/IP. And he was on a panel and he talked about something called Shor's algorithm. And I had to wiki that. I had no idea what Shor's algorithm was. But then I found out it had something to do with quantum computing and this idea that instead of computing being underlied by bits and bytes, it was the underlying physical representation was actually quantum mechanics. And so quantum particles. And instead of computing with ones and zeros, ons and offs, you're suddenly computing with quantum particles that are in superpositions, combinations of ones and zeros, with all the quantum strangeness that you hear about that kind of frustrated Einstein. So 4 years ago, I found out that we could do things in the future. We'll be able to do things exponentially faster, solve problems, solve real-world problems like drug discovery or feeding the population by using algorithms that are supported by quantum computers. And so it was both very intellectually interesting as well as something that I think it will be incredibly useful. And so I shifted my career direction from classical computing to quantum computing about 4 years ago, and then got picked up by IBM a couple of years ago as a quantum developer advocate to help people get up to speed on quantum computing.
So tell us exactly what a quantum developer advocate does.
So a quantum developer advocate is one that that goes to conferences and speaks about quantum computing. And IBM's, you know, since I work for IBM, our particular quantum computing framework called Qiskit, Q-I-S-K-I-T. We've built several quantum computers that the public can use for free, as well as our partners can use them, the more powerful ones and the more ones that are more dedicated to them. I also write blogs and articles and demos and things like that. So that's the idea, kind of a developer relations kind of thing, and teaching and those kinds of things.
Do you see that catching on? Are people expressing interest in that way of thinking,
people,
way of computing?
People are, especially physicists.
Okay.
That's the kind of the first audience, the ones that get it first because they've already gone to university to understand, you know, how the quantum mechanical phenomena work, or things like, you know, things that happen quantum mechanically that don't happen visibly, right? Because as soon as we see it, it's measured and collapse. It collapses, states collapse, so we can't see what's happening underneath, but we can certainly we know what's there through experiments. So some of these things that happen under the covers, right, but where we can't see them, that we can compute with, though, are things like superpositions, interference, entanglement. And so physicists are trained in those things, so they get it immediately. And my classical developer friends, they're my audience. I didn't go to college to be a physicist. My training is in classical computer development, software development. And so I've had to climb the learning curve to some degree. And so my passion is to help other of my colleagues climb that learning curve. And yeah, it is picking up. They're catching on. They're understanding, as I do, that it's a fun area, a very intellectually rewarding area. But it's also very relevant. It's something where we don't have real powerful quantum computers today that can do some of the things that we hope they will at some point. But we can work with toy problems with these same algorithms. And by jumping in now, these developers can then learn, and as the technology matures, they can be on board and solve problems.
So is that a technology that someday everyday users will take advantage of, or that they'll see some kind of change in the way they do computing based upon that technology?
I think it's like GPUs, for example, like graphical processing units. Mm-hmm. So they're very specialized. Mm-hmm. And back before then, you may recall that they used to have things called CPUs. Remember CPUs? And then there was something where if you needed to do some calculations, then you would farm that out to another kind of processing unit. Then they had GPUs for graphical processing. So what I envision is something called like QPUs, quantum processing units. Mm-hmm. So there's this subclass of problems that quantum computers are very good at. Not all problems, you know. There are just some that that because of the quantum mechanical nature that they're good at. Mm-hmm. So classical computers aren't going away, but there are certain aspects of some problems that you might want to solve. One of the classical examples would be the traveling salesman problem, where you have a salesperson that needs to go to 100 cities, visit each once, and then you're trying to find the optimal path in terms of miles. So that becomes what's called a combinatorial optimization problem.
My brain is exploding right now.
I know. This is excellent. And especially this very practical example with the salesman. This is my husband's job just not too long ago, trying to figure out the quickest path and how to cover all of his different areas in the best way. So this is really interesting.
Is it kind of like the one that a train leaves Kansas City at 5 o'clock going 70 miles an hour, another one leaves Indianapolis, when will they meet? That kind of thing?
It's a little bit like...
That's my level of thinking. Just
no,
so
it's,
you
a,
know.
It's a little bit like it's, if you had 100 cities, then there might be 2^100 power of combinations of cities, of paths that you could take. Hmm. And then you need to evaluate which of the best path would be as far as optimizing for distance or for gas or whatever. Hmm. And so classically, with a classical computer, you would have to check each of those combinations. Yeah. And if you had 2^100 power of combinations, that's a one with 30 zeros after it, right? So the universe may burn out. Before Christ may come back, right? Before this thing actually happens. So
can I make the assumption then that when you're using this quantum technology, that it's also incredibly, it's faster?
Well, the reason it can be faster, but that's because of the algorithm that you can then apply to a problem like that is different than you could apply classically. Hmm. So to solve it classically and to completely, you know, be sure that you found the optimal path, you've got to visit those 1^30 combinations after it, right? But with quantum computing, because of the fact that you can represent each of the 100 destinations with something called a quantum bit, rather than just a bit, a 1 and 0, but a quantum bit, which can be 1 or 0 or any combination, then the computation can be such that you take these 100 quantum bits and then kind of put them in states in these superpositions and then run an algorithm that's expressed in quantum computing instructions. And you could do that particular problem in a time that's what's called quadratically faster. So let's say you had 1,000,000 combinations. Instead of having to go through 1,000,000 combinations, you could do the query, you know, you could check the square root of 1,000,000, which would be 1,000 times, right? So as that scales up, then, you know, the square root becomes a much more efficient number. And so, yeah, so you can apply those kinds of things.
That concludes the end of part one of our series on quantum computing with Jim Weaver, but we're going to be back again next week with part two.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.